Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney, you're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Hi, and welcome to this week's FX Podcast. I'm Mike Seymour. Well, this week we're going to take our break from our series on the tech behind feature films, though that will be returning next week with a really interesting look at facial animation coming out from the team at Weta. But this week we're going to take a break and have a look at the cartoon industry, as it were, or the animation field. Now, this is a really interesting industry, and we're going to be looking at it from a different kind of perspective. I actually believe that cartoon animation was, in fact, the first true American art form, predating the American sort of pop art or abstract expressionist or any of the big art movements. I think this stuff really is art. But we're not going to be looking at it from an artistic point of view today so much as from the business point of view, because we're going to be talking, or rather Jeff is, sitting down and talking to Tom Cito, the retired president of the Screen Cartoonist Guild. He's an author, he's an animator, animation director, on the faculty of USC Film School, and wrote a book called The Untold Story of Animation Unions, From Bosco to Bart Simpson. Now, this is a book that's available on Amazon, and it's a really interesting book for discussing, obviously, the evolution and changing fortunes, if you like, of what happened with the animation unions in America. In particular, this is obviously a very strong issue in America. It's a particular interest, I guess, a lot of listening in California. And I think what's interesting is that to look at what a union may or may not involve for any industry, it's always good to look at a parallel industry that's gone through it. And so having someone like Tom able to discuss it and discuss it in such a relevant context is really important. Now, Jeff's a huge fan of this book from Tom, and so you'll hear them discuss that and also some of the lessons learned, and just basically get a window on this interesting labor issue that's developing, especially, as I say, in the North American market at the moment. Let's cross now to Jeff and his interview with Tom Cito.
Well, thanks for joining us, Tom. I've been looking forward to this. I'm a big fan of the book, and I listened to the Animation Guild does some, I guess you'd call them oral histories. So I heard that couple-hour piece with you and Steve Hewlett recorded here at Local 839, the Animation Guild. And I really respect the Animation Guild for gathering those. They have quite a few of those. It's kind of interesting to check out. I know the Visual Effects Society has been talking about doing that. I don't know if they've actually done it, but it's nice to see that stuff actually on the webpage and people to be able to check that stuff out. So if people want to listen to a longer interview about more history and animation, I recommend they check that out. And I'll put links to those in the story. But what I wanted to talk to you about today is there's a lot of talk right now about the visual effects union, a possibility of organizing. IATSE and IBEW are both kind of announced their intentions for that. And I keep hearing a lot of the same arguments. And as I was reading your book, I thought, wow, there's a lot of history here that kind of debunks a lot of stuff. So I wanted to kind of get into that. Why don't we start off with tell us a little bit about yourself first, and then we'll move to that.
Okay, well, thank you, and thank you for the interview. I started in the mid-1970s, and I was fortunate enough that as I began my career in the 70s, a lot of Golden Age-era artists who would work for Disney and Warner Brothers and all were sort of ending their careers. So we sort of overlapped a bit. And, you know, I had a chance to, you know, clutch their wrinkly knees and, like, tell me your secrets, old man. Tell me, you know, like this, kind of like the way my students are doing to me now. Much the same. One of the things I found interesting was the amount of passion left over, like, you know, residual passion from the big strikes in the 30s and 40s. And, you know, the strike at Fleischer's in 1937 and then the one at Disney's, particularly in 1941. And it's funny because when you read the official corporate histories, it's like everything was fun, you know, like everything was wacky and, you know, and you jumped in the pool and you had a, you know, barbecue and you know, Walt played the guitar and everybody sang, you know, and then you talk to the artists and they've still got this residual anger, you know, towards one another. And I thought, what created this type of passion that even at the end of their lives in their 80s they still are nursing this, you know, resentment towards one another? And I was fortunate enough to be friends with a lot of the original activists, you know, in the guilds in the 30s and 40s. And then I also knew some of the people who were very pro-Walt and cross picket lines and, you know. And it was fascinating to get their responses, and basically, their ideas. There was a historian in the early part of the 20th century named Stefan Zweig, and Zweig was a disciple of Jung, and all the books that he wrote were historical biographies. But they always had a point to them, he picked some very unusual people. Like he wrote a biography of Magellan, and he wrote a biography of Marie Antoinette, But anyway, he wrote this biography of this French a general named Marshal Grouchy, who was the commander of Napoleon's reserves at the Battle of Waterloo. And basically, by following explicit instructions and not taking the personal initiative, he kept one-third of the French army out of the battle. And later, like when his generals were saying, you should ride to the sound of the guns. The emperor's in trouble. We should do something. And he says, everybody just can't gallop willy-nilly around. You should stick to your instructions. And later Napoleon ran into him and like, you have ruined France, and just screaming all over the place. But anyway, Zweig's point was, Grouchy lived another 40 years after that date. And imagine if you had to spend the remainder of your life explaining your thought processes on one hot June afternoon, which is kind of fascinating. And I think it's the same thing with these strikes, was that you had all these people, regardless of their own personal political views, if you're very leftist, if you're very conservative or whatever, that one morning on Buena Vista, in front of the studio in 1941, when there was a picket line and everybody had to decide whose side were they on. Like you couldn't just talk about it and let it roll off your back. You had to make a choice.
What was the catalyst? I mean, what started it? What was the main issue?
Well, the issue was non-standardized salaries were all over the place, and you could be fired on a whim. It's a famous story about Disney was walking through the hallways and he overheard somebody telling a dirty joke, and he wasn't even saying it to him. He actually had just sort of eavesdropped it as he walked by, and he fired the guy. there was that type of thing, and he would also raise your salary based on if he liked your face or whatever, he felt that he was a self-made man, it was a self-made company, and he had been through all the rough and tumble of building a studio from nothing. So he rightly felt that he was like, the patron, he was the father of his people. The thing is, most of the books written about Disney from that time period are written by people who were very close to him. And their fortunes were tied to him, and they did very well, So obviously, there's a lot of fierce loyalty there, and it was sort of a revelation to meet people who didn't have a good experience at the studio, because their stories were almost never told, I think the catalyst for the 41 strike was really the end of a long period of organization that began with FDR passing the Wagner Act in 1935, saying all American workers have the right to bargain collectively and to form unions without harassment, which is something that would be nice to have again today. but the Hollywood unions all formed like between like 1935 and 1940, like that. Plus, most of the industry, which is not well known, was on a 6-day work week then. You had to work Saturday for regular time. It wasn't a choice. And early in 41, the studios went to a 40-hour week, almost to kind of head off impending unionization. And I noticed, because at the time I was writing this, the same thing was kind of happening in a lot of CG houses and all, that they normally had like a 50 to 60-hour work week. And then suddenly they started making big announcements like, oh, yeah, we're going to 40. I thought, oh, you're just keeping up with the rest of the country to pass these laws in like 1913,
No. Yeah. It's funny to me, the I would probably say in my school years, history was my worst subject, and I didn't understand that. And I think it's not unusual for, 18, 20-year-olds to not care much about history. Mm-hmm. As I've gotten older, I've kind of become more interested in psychology, mm-hmm, and history, and seen how politicians who are more studied in history seem to be smarter to me. And so when I, you know, on your blog every day, there's a giant list of history. So I take it you're a big fan of history in general.
Yeah, it's always been a hobby of mine since I was very young. And I joke with my students and say that, you know, when your full-time job is fantasy, reality is where you go to relax. And what I find funny is that when you find really interesting history, fiction kind of pales. You know, you're sort of reading things, and you can see the parallels. You know, like I always like history that has a bit of a connection with human beings. You know, and you can see foibles, and you can see, you know, repeating things. You know, in our current day, that have echoes of what happened before.
Well, and thinking of that, a couple of the things that I hear all the time now, and even in recent articles and trade magazines and newspapers and stuff, you know, phrases like the ship has sailed, it's too late to have a visual effects union, or all the jobs are going to be sent offshore, everything's going to be outsourced. I mean, I read your book and I go, yep, heard that before.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, animation certainly had a huge outsourcing dilemma for a long time. And yet, I noticed on the Animation Guild blog, Steve Hewlett posted just the other day, this quote: "There's more animation cartoon work employing more people in and around Los Angeles than at any other time in the history of the business."
Yeah, that's true. That's true. You know, there was these cyclical waves where in 1979 the Guild was at a peak when everything was traditional and everything was done in LA County. Then again, we had strikes. We tried to nail down domestic content so that you could, you know, keep stuff here in the city. And with varying success and all. And then a lot of stuff went overseas, and it was a recession. And then the mid-'80s were lean. And then by 1990, we were back up and almost doubled the number of people we had. You know, and this was even with the outsourcing. And again, too, in 2003, there was a bit of a turnover as the animation industry was going digital, going completely from a majority 2D to a majority 3D. But yeah, even now our numbers are still at an all-time high.
Well, I hear the word outsourcing used all the time, and I'm always I never look at it. There seems to be hysteria around the word, mm-hmm. and I look at it as a maturing of an industry. It's going to happen naturally, and it's happened naturally in every industry as it matures. Yeah. You know, we've seen it, garment, animation, everything. It just happens. It's just what happens, and the world needs all the same things and sees markets and wants to enter markets, and that's what happens. I guess in terms of the artists – one of the comments one of the things I've observed in going to some of these union meetings that I've seen around town to observe what's going on is that I'm artists just don't consider themselves labor.
Yeah, I know. Yeah,
is that the same? Is that universal?
Yeah, there's a particular sort of a smugness about it, and again, I've been a professional artist my entire life. And I've been around creative people my entire life, and there is a funny attitude about artists with this sort of they're not joiners, you know, and it's always like, don't tell me what to do. I want to do what I want, and you sit there and it's an eye opener to them when I say, ballet dancers are unionized, Broadway, crews are unionized, writers are unionized. SAG and the Writers Guild, they're not just clubs,
Right. Like, NFL players, there's a whole big thing going on right NFL now with that, but the coming season.
I mean, can you think of a job that's more singularly individual than a writer, sitting alone and, in a room with your Microsoft or, whatever, your copy of Final Draft and dependent on no one else, yet they have a very strong union.
Sure. Well, the recent SAG Awards were just on, and I was amazed at the number of quotes, I'll put them in the article actually, that I pulled. Natalie Portman, Melissa Leo, Juliana Margulies, all made very passionate the discussion about the SAG and AFTRA coming together was on their minds, obviously, but just very passionate little short sentences that they snuck into their speeches about the union and how happy they are. And Natalie Portman thanked them for, helping her with her education and making sure that she got the education while she was working as a young actress and stuff like that. So, I mean, it certainly – you know, actors, writers, artists, certainly are all benefiting from these things.
I just want to add, too, that, you know, like it was an eye-opener for me when I would talk to, again, like some of these older Hollywood artists from the Golden Age, like, you know, like Maurice Noble. Maurice Noble was the designer who, the reason why the Roadrunners look the way they do, and the reason why the 1950s Bugs Bunnies look the way they do, you know, very stylized backgrounds and all, was Maurice. Maurice was he was an art director at Disney's, and he was the senior art director at on the Looney Tunes and the Warner Brothers stuff. And he told me in his old age that he was living on his on basically on his union pension, his union benefits, Social Security, and you know, and he would sell lithographs. And it was kind of a shock to me because I thought, here's this guy who's this legend, and you find out a lot of Hollywood legends, you know, just being a legend doesn't mean you're rich. You know, there's the famous story of. I think the fellow's name was Jack Pierce, but he was the makeup man for Universal in the 30s. And he's the guy who basically created the Frankenstein monster. Because if you look at Mary Shelley's book, all it says is sewn from dead bodies, really big. And there's no description. Mm-hmm. And Jack Pierce is the one who came up with the flat top and the sutures and the electrodes on the neck and the look.
The iconic look.
Yes. He got paid straight salary. He got nothing else. And in his old age, when he was retired and replaced by cheaper, younger kids, he actually tried to sue, and he got Boris Karloff to kind of stick up for him because Boris Karloff was a big one in the he was very union active, and they lost. The judge was like, "You got paid." Tough, you know, and a lot of Hollywood's like that. It's like, you know, yeah, you're a legend, but, you know, I mean, even Humphrey Bogart once said in the 50s, he said, in Hollywood, they love you so long as you can make them a buck. As soon as that stops, they forget you ever existed.
So true. Well, it's also, that's an interesting parallel, though, with a lot of what happens right now in visual effects and, well, in all of our industry that, you know, we are now creating characters that could live on forever and be born in other movies and things like that. And you do wonder about how that works. And yeah, you're getting paid to create it, but you know, there's certainly an ownership part there that is interesting to think about.
Yeah, I mean, you know, think of a movie like you know, Ice Age 3 or Shrek 4. They're not even the original. They're like the third or fourth sequel. You know, Ice Age 3 made $887 million around the world. That's almost $1 billion for one movie. That's unbelievable.
Yeah, yeah. talking about the artist not consuming his labor, the other thought I had on that is that a lot of the union fears that you hear are based on, teachers unions or automobile unions. But yet the history of animation unions is completely different in that regard.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a defined policy of I won't say disinformation, but there's that great line in the Usual Suspects when Kevin Spacey says, the greatest victory the devil ever had is making us believe he doesn't exist.
Nice.
Isn't that nice? Yeah, and it's true, and it's the same thing. It's like the greatest victory that media has ever had is to tell you you don't need unions, like they're not necessary. It's like not just that they're bad. Like in the 50s, they used to say you're you know, commies from hell and godless and atheistic, socialistic, whatever. Now it's just that you don't exist and you're not necessary and everything's fine the way it is. And it's like, no, it's not.
You know? Yeah. Well, I like Steve Hewlett's line. He uses quite frequently the fear, uncertainty, and doubt.
Yeah.
That those are the guiding principles. You have to kind of run – you kind of have to run when you hear things through a filter and go, wait a minute, is this being used to manipulate me with those things? Because those are certainly human things that are very easy to play on.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, what I find fascinating is that even my friends who are very who are like, you know, politics junkies, you know, and just love to like listen to, you know, they watch MSNBC or they watch Fox and they're in on all the talk shows, you know, the talking heads, and they love to argue about Iraq and the different politics and stuff. When you try to put it to your own situation and you say, well, you say, you know, don't believe everything corporations tell you. Well, corporations are telling you you don't need collective bargaining. You don't need a union. Like unions are all on the waterfront. You know, they're all like hooligans. You know, with no necks, with names like, you know, Vinny and like, hey you. You know, you know, and I mean, and that stuff still goes on today. I mean, you still see in movies. Whenever you see the union guy, he's always, hey brother, I'm gonna knock your head off. You know.
Yeah, yeah, that's true.
Like.
Well, thinking back, a friend of mine helped me with some of the questions on this because he and I have talked quite a bit about your book as he read it and he referred it to me. And one of the things he asked me to ask you about was the in the book, there's a lot of the culture of the time that kind of influenced the thing. For example, there was a lot more communities, local organizations, church was a big factor.
Yeah.
Things that really, I mean, they're still around today, but maybe have less of a societal impact than they did at that time. Mm-hmm. That maybe made it more, people were more reliant on each other, more opportunity to talk outside of work and maybe those type of environments. Whereas, you know, I think animation crews now are younger, maybe less family oriented, more individualistic. Do you see that?
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, it's a sort of thing that, you know, for people who live in an earthquake zone, did you ever notice that, like, whenever there's a tremor or something, everybody comes out in the street, you meet all your neighbors and you go, are you okay? Did you turn your gas off? You know, or if you're on the East Coast, if you're in a blizzard or something, you see your neighbors outside and say hi and you go, you know, can I borrow your snowblower? Or like, if you help me shovel out my driveway, I'll help you with yours. There's something about those big incidents that has a way to kind of get us out of our cubbyholes and get us talking. And the Great Depression was that for a lot of American society. It was a great leveler. Like, suddenly everybody from the commonest worker to like F. Scott Fitzgerald felt screwed by the system. Like, everybody felt and they were all in the same boat, which is this terrible situation that happened. And it had a way of affecting the way people thought of themselves. I mean, people like, you know, artists like Grant Wood or Andrew Wyeth wouldn't just be like, I'm an artist, you know. They're like, yeah, I'm a painter and it's what I do, you know. And it was sort of a working class ethic to it. I think old Congressman Tip O'Neill years ago was talking about the big change that Reagan brought about in the 80s. And that was, he says, when I was young, everybody identified with working class people. And he says, starting in the 80s, everybody identified with the rich. Like everybody's like, you know, in this day and age, you hear people say, yeah, but, you know, Bernie Madoff had a point also. You know, I mean, we shouldn't be so hard on him. Like, yes, we should.
Yeah.
You know, but the fact that, like, people are immediately willing to take the side of the extremely wealthy.
And by the fantasy.
Yeah, I think it's a fantasy, yeah. I think it's like thinking, oh, I can be that someday, you know, someday I will get there as well.
The tax cuts for the highest percentage always made me think, well, wait, how can this even be defensible, you know?
Yeah.
It's the same kind of thing. It's like that, well, I could get there someday. It's like, yeah.
And it took a long time to kind of raise generations in that attitude of that you don't really need anyone but yourself. And I mean, the capitalist kind of Horatio Alger incentive has always been there since the earliest days of America. There's always been the, you know, if you, like Andrew Carnegie, you know, a little 14-year-old boy in a coal mine and he saved his pennies and like, right. And then he became a billionaire, you know. And it's like, well, you know, it does happen for a couple of people, just like a couple of people win the lottery, you know. But the great mass of us are hoping for the same kind of, you know, thing. And it's a real pie in the sky kind of attitude.
Yeah. Historically, the unions were kind of responsible for the 8-hour day, for example.
Yeah.
Right? And work weeks.
And weekends. Weekends like, the reason you have Saturday and Sunday off, you know. You know what I mean? Like, no employer ever did this out of altruism. You know, like, nobody woke up in the morning and went, what a nice day. I think I'll give women the same wage parity with men. Yeah. And like, that doesn't happen. Right. There is no such thing.
Right. It's about the mutual interest and common goals of the workers, which I guess is what the unions represent in theory. I'm really trying to get to the history of this and how. There's problems even getting people to show up at meetings, and I got to tell you, I'm a little frustrated with the current organizational efforts on the visual effects side, just because they're kind of going on as the. A model that I would say would be more akin to probably the old days of organizing. They're doing individual personal meetings and there's no, you know, visual effects artists live on the internet. They listen to podcasts. They're on Twitter, you know, and you know, I've got close to 2,000 followers on Twitter, and you know, 140 character tweet hits them in a second, as opposed to organizing a meeting in a bar.
Yeah.
You know, now obviously you can get more information out when you're standing in front of a group of people, but you know, it just, I look at it, I used the example the other day to someone that I feel like they're selling vacuums door to door, and meanwhile, I just ordered a Dyson ball on the internet, you know, and it you know, it's a different world.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't know how to inspire people to get out and get the information about what these guys are trying to do and what benefits they could get from joining a union. Because, I mean, frankly, I'm not sold yet, and I should be, because I've been researching this for years now, and kind of trying to wonder what's going on in our business, what's happening here.
Yeah.
And I'm not sold because they haven't sold me.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I wasn't either for the longest time. I mean, you know, when I was younger and all, I just felt like a union was an organization of has-beens who are just basically created a structure to kind of keep what they got and keep down young people and keep us out of like more important positions and better money and stuff. And that was my attitude for the longest time. And it wasn't until I started to, you know, like I was working with larger studios and also, you know, I directed and I've worked with producers and I've worked with a lot of on the other side, on the sort of the management side of things. And then you see the attitude of like people. Like the thing is, everybody has this idea of like if you're really talented, then, you know, Michael Eisner will drop to his knees and shower you with money, you know, and that's all you need. And it's like, I'm sorry, Mozart died poor. You know, Rembrandt declared bankruptcy. You know, it's like Michelangelo got sued. It's like, you know, it's not just talent.
He got screwed by the Pope.
Yeah, really. He got screwed by a lot of people. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it was a thing. I think it was like he was working on the tomb for Pope Julius, you know, II, and Julius kept saying, "Oh, well, you got time for that? I want you to paint this ceiling. No, wait, I want you to do this. I want you to do this," you know. And then the Pope died and everything, and then Pope Leo came and said, "I want you to work for me now, but I got to finish this tomb." He got, no, you got to work for me. So then he got sued by Julius's family. Like, you can't win, you know.
Yeah.
So I think it's that. You know, it is that kind of there is that sort of perception of what a union is, and I think part of it is cutting through all that mythology, all that on the waterfront sort of stuff, and kind of getting it down to a bare bones of what it originally was, which was a bunch of artists or a bunch of people of like interests getting together. And kind of saying, you know, why can't we talk about conditions as a group instead of just as one-on-one type nonsense? I mean, there's a great story about James Cagney when he first came to Hollywood, and he writes about it in his memoirs. You know, he was like a vaudeville dancer or something, and then when movies went to sound, he had that thick New York accent, and he looked like a young street hood, and they just said, "Oh, he's perfect for the type of movies we want to do now." So they brought him out here to be a gangster, and he did Public Enemy. It was a giant hit and stuff, and he signed a 7-year contract with Warner's for $500 a week. And he's like, "Wow, I'm making $500 a week," which was a lot to him at the time. And he's like, "Well, you know." And then he met Edward G. Robinson, the other famous gangster movie star working for Warner Brothers. And he goes, "I'm making $500 a week." And Edward G. said, "I'm making $5,000 a week." And Cagney says, "I want to renegotiate my contract." And the management went, "You're a communist." And therein is the Hollywood story.
Yes, indeed. That's very good. That's very good.
You know, and Cagney became a big backer of the early of the Actors Guild. You know, he was like one of the first actors to say, you know, we gotta come up with some a ground floor. We have to come up with rules. I mean, this doing this without a union, it's like playing a baseball game without umpires and coaches. It's a free-for-all. It's all over the place, you know. And what's interesting with Cagney was that he was so active in the guilds and all that at one point some people in management in the studios he was at even started to talk to gangsters about maybe having an accident, like drop some lights on him or something. And what happened was his friend George Raft found out. And George Raft was, you know, the one that the Richard Gere character in Cotton Club is based on, where George Raft really was friends with real gangsters. I mean, he grew up in the Hell's Kitchen area of Manhattan playing with Lucky Luciano and Meyer Lansky and all these people who became tops in the underworld. So George Raft called his friends that were bigger gangsters than the gangsters the studio had hired. And then like 10 years later, he told Cagney, "Oh, by the way, I saved your life once."
Wow.
Pretty scary.
Yeah, exactly. Let's talk a little bit about the book more specifically. Let's just describe it for people. I really, like I said earlier, I really want to recommend people check it out. I put a recommendation on a few weeks ago about it on the site. And but just tell us in your words kind of how you describe the book.
Well, you know, I know something something like labor history isn't like on everybody's must read for the summer. You know, I mean, you know, the co-eds in spring break aren't rolling around on the beach in Daytona. Like, yeah, I think I'll read this Hollywood labor history of animation. You know, so if it's just like dry discussions of negotiating for time and a half and all, it would get. I like to humanize history, and I like to put in a lot of anecdote. And I also like to tie it into not just cartoons, but also to realize that, like, they're like, you know, like nobody's working in a bubble. You know, like people working in the cartoon business, you know, thought they were part of the general scope of Hollywood. And a lot of people who were working in the art departments at studios and the art departments and cartoon studios felt also that they were artists. You know, like instead of like I'm an animation artist, I'm an artist who does animation. And that was kind of an eye-opener when I heard that, you know, a lot of these folks after work or something would go to a friend's house and they put on jazz records and they'd rap about Kandinsky and George O'Keefe and, you know, what's Frida Kahlo doing in Mexico City. And you know, and it's very interesting. So I tried to capture a lot of that one-on-one conversations I had with a lot of golden age artists. Like, you'd sit around with a beer and one of them would say, "You know, someday somebody should write all this stuff down in a book." Like, okay, I did.
Well, and as I read it, I found myself constantly just thinking, wow, that whole thing, this little section here, you could just take out the word animation and put in visual effects, and it applies 100% today as it did then.
Yeah, I mean, one of the leading top digital effects houses that had done a lot of like big productions and stuff was the subject of a class action lawsuit from its workers, and talking about all the uncompensated hours they put in. They put in like 80-100 hours and get paid for 40. And so they explained the system at the time as they did comp time, which is you bank hours. And, in fact, one of the guys working there told me, I have enough comp time, I could take 2 years off on full salary.
And that'll never happen.
That'd be great. Yeah, yeah. But the thing that I flashed on was that in 1935, the Labor Relations Board had a grievance filed, the same kind of thing, a suit of some animation artists at a studio in New York. And Burton Gillette, who was the director at the time, who had directed the Oscar-winning film, for Disney, Three Little Pigs, I was testifying in Washington, and he was saying that his studio worked on comp time. And it was like, wow. There's a direct connection. You know, it's the same old story. You know, people didn't like it back then either.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing that just as I keep saying as I read the book, as I just kept saying, you know, none of this is new information in terms of what's going on today. It's all stuff that's happened to other people, and then we really need to go back and learn and see and dispel these myths, these things that get perpetuated over and over again, because we know how it's going to turn out. We can go back and see how it turned out.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I mean, I've never been one to say that the people who own companies are just out to oppress you and torture you and stuff. And it's not I haven't always seen it as an us against them kind of thing. But there is the thing of good fences make good neighbors, you know. And I was surprised when I was working, at some big studios and some of our production, you know, the producers that we had come from Broadway. like we were using a lot of theater people in the 90s. And a lot of these folks had worked with Actors Equity and worked with the Broadway locals and stuff. And it's sort of funny because they adapt this hard line in a negotiation. And then privately, you know, after the talks would break up, they would say to me, they go, yeah, good luck. You know, I really don't understand why your people aren't more unionized. You know, I mean, it's so much in their best interest, you know. And I thought it was kind of cool that they had no problem with the union kind of concept, you know, because it was so it was such a day-to-day thing working in you know on legitimate stage. And it is funny because, you know, I'd be looking at them going, I don't understand it either, you know. So.
Yeah. Well, and taking it globally, I mean, my opinion has always been that unions may not be a concept globally or allowed in some places even, but the problems are the same. You know, things may start off with cheap labor, but that changes quickly. Yeah. And, you know, especially with the internet, my feeling is that, you know, the time for information to be spread is a lot shorter because, you know, the guy working for peanuts doing the same job that somebody else is doing is going to know pretty quickly what that's worth in other places,
yeah,
and want to be there.
Oh yeah, I mean, there's been stories about burnout in the anime industry in Japan, where you know a lot of artists work very hard, very long hours on Japanese films, and you know they're magnificent films and all, but there is a certain amount of exhaustion with when am I going to see something from all this work, you know. And I was working in Taipei a few years ago. And I'd always heard this thing about, I was directing a film for the government, and I'd always heard these things about, the Chinese workers sleep at their desks and they live there and all this, you know, and all these things. And I was prepared for that, and I found a really well run, well ordered studio that everybody went home at 5 o'clock. And nobody was there on the weekend because when I first got there, my internet wasn't set up yet. So I go into the studio to read my email and things. And I go there on a Saturday, and I was there alone. And I thought, wait a minute, what about this, like, this labor situation I had heard about? I mean, you know, that's the impression I had. You know,
yeah. So. What are you working on now? Can you talk about that?
Yeah, well, you know, I've been teaching more, more full time at USC and UCLA, some other places, and I'm back storyboarding on some 3D Roadrunner shorts, which the Warners did a series of them last year. They did three that came out with movies, and
they won for some awards too, weren't they?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. They did well, and then so the director called me back to help out with another set. And they're kind of fun. It's fun to work with the old characters, you know, and to give it that classic look, except that, you know, they're in 3D now, you know. And
yeah, that's got to be an interesting process.
Yeah. It's different, you know. It's different. And then you're trying to, keep the spirit of the originals. And all, and you know, like I joke around, I said, you know, I tell people that, you know, I used to know Chuck Jones personally, and people look at me like I knew Lincoln, you know.
Yeah, I said, believe that. I'm with you.
He was a real guy, you know. Up until recently, he was around and, you know, telling jokes like the rest of us, you know. And and really, I feel like I'm sort of helping keep, you know, his legacy going and keeping these, you know, these wonderful characters.
Oh yeah,
you know. I mean, you know, the amazing thing about a film like, let's say, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs or Bugs Bunny, a lot of those things were created before any of us were born. Like, never mind the younger people, but, you know, the older people too. I mean, how many movies from 1938 do you, like, go out of your way to see? You know, like, boy, I really want to see Little Miss Marker, or I really want to see Saratoga Trunk. You know, like, nobody remembers these movies. But Snow White is just as fresh as the year it came out.
Oh, if you watch a kid watching, you know, Roadrunner cartoons, totally enthralled, totally, you know, today.
Yeah.
It applies, you know, there's no difference between somebody watching it then and now.
Oh yeah, and the old ones are full of 40s anachronisms, you know, allusions, just jokes about gas rationing and blue plate specials, and I find myself having to like explain things to people, but people just enjoy it. They just have a laugh, you know. I'm still getting jokes, you know. There's this one joke in the first Yosemite Sam where Yosemite Sam is chasing Bugs through the cars of this train, and Bugs locks the door to one, and Sam is banging on the door and going, "Open the door, Rabbit! Open the door! I say, open the door!" And then he looks at the audience and goes, "You notice I didn't say Richard?" You know, and I've seen this cartoon like 800 times. And one day I was listening to the radio, and they had the old time radio show on where they played like pop tunes from the 40s, 30s, and 40s. And there was a pop song in 1941 by Louis Jordan and the Modern Heirs called "Open the Door, Richard." I finally get that joke.
Oh my god! Wow.
But it never diminished my enjoyment of the cartoon,
right?
But now right. I just understand it a little better, even. So
wow, that's wild. Yeah. Well, there's a lot of that. I mean, that's been very popular in a lot of the DreamWorks movies, especially now. A lot of the cultural references and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I worked on Aladdin, and I remember like Robin Williams was doing all his free associations, doing jokes about Jack Nicholson, he was doing like this. And we had a long argument in the story department when Williams did an Ed Sullivan impersonation. It's okay, does anybody under the age of 50 remember Ed Sullivan? I remember what he sounded like, but it's like, it's like doing an impersonation of, Bennett Cerf or Dorothy Kilgallen. But anyway, the interesting thing is that when they ran it for kids, kids just laughed, and he made a funny face, But he does Ed Sullivan, he does Jack Nicholson, and he does Arsenio Hall.
Yeah,
doing the whoo whoo whoo.
That's right.
And I think that dated faster,
way faster than
the Ed Sullivan illusion did.
Very interesting.
But people still people still enjoy Aladdin. They still have a good time.
Well, it's interesting too that the crossovers between visual effects now and animation. I mean, Train Your Dragon did very well at the VES Awards, for example. There's not a lot of difference anymore between what we do, other than maybe. We have in visual effects often would be considered more live action.
Yeah, I mean,
mixture.
I always like to joke and say that 10, 20 years ago, because I've done some programs with the at the Academy with the Science and Technology Council, and I was joking around with the guys there, and I said, 20 years ago, when you said visual effects, it was these guys with gray ponytails, and little universal tool on their belt, setting off charges in garbage cans, and now it's all animators. And it's all become animation, and it's funny because one of the guys there, Tad, was saying, "Yeah, but I kind of missed the demos when they used to blow up stuff on stage." Me too.
That's great. Well, where can people find out more? I mean, I know I mentioned the blog earlier and the website, tomcito.com. Is that the best place for people to see
and,
more?
You could do a search for me on Amazon, and that'll go there in Barnes & Noble.
Oh, yeah, let's get the name of the book is Drawing the Line, The Untold Story of the Animation Unions. From Bosco to Bart Simpson. It's also available in Kindle form.
Yes,
thank you for that.
Yeah.
So those of us with iPads and Kindles appreciate that.
Oh, yeah.
And like you said, it's not you're not going to go to the beach and read it, but I read it over a period of time and on airplanes, and I really appreciated it, and I think a lot more people could learn from history, and I'm now becoming more of a fan of history and understanding it than I was when I was in school, as I mentioned. So.
Thank you. Yeah, and it's funny because I've been, I'm also like, I haven't stopped writing and everything. I've got a new book coming up, and that is I'm writing a history of computer graphics from the beginning. Because I suddenly thought to myself, there's the famous historian Thucydides was an ancient Greek who was an Athenian general at one point, and then at one point he kind of sort of stood off to one side and watched this giant war between Athens and Sparta go on for like 30 years, and I thought to myself. Like Thucydides, I kind of saw that – I kind of was a witness to the digital revolution rising. I mean, I remember going to seeing Peter Fol's Hunger for the first time and Tony DePaltry. And I remember going to my first SIGGRAPH in 85. And, I was in the studio when the Pixar guys were pitching Toy Story. And I thought, well, I'm in a position now where I can, because I do know all the pioneers, and where I, like I did with the union guys, and I said I can really kind of talk to them about this industry, because I find that most of the books are written by engineers, and God bless them, they're geniuses, but the stuff gets very technical, you know. And then also there's, you know, the people who write about ILM, and it's like everything great was done by ILM, and the people who write about Pixar, everything great was done by Pixar, which is fine. They're just good, you know. But I like to get in the whole picture, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, things like government flight simulators and the universities, like University of Utah, New York Institute of Technology, and the National Film Board of Canada, and all the different, you know, there's not a linear track for computer graphics. It's like with film, it's like they invented film, they go to sound, they go to videotape, and television. There's a straight progression that you can follow, you know, and track a few geniuses like Cecil B. DeMille and Walt Disney. You know. With CG, it's sort of like you've got Bohemian artists like experimenters like the Whitneys, you know, the Whitney brothers, and then you've got motion picture and visual effects, then you've got games, then you've got the government. You know, the government put a lot of money in flight in virtual reality for jet pilot simulations in the 60s, and a lot of that software became the stuff that we're using today, just developed. When Ivan Sutherland wrote Sketchpad in 1962, which was the first program where a computer drew a line instead of dots, he was using a decommissioned Cold War computer that MIT had invented and was basically used to track Soviet nukes coming over the North Pole. And, you know, and they'd gone to a newer generation, so they said, well, let the kid play with this, and, you know, we'll justify our foundation grant, you know.
Well, when you did that book together, we'll have to sit down and talk again. I'd love to talk to you about that how far away do you think that is?
I'm trying to wrap up the manuscript this year and everything, so hopefully it'll come out in early 2012. It's funny, too, because, you know, you work in movies and everything's like, now, I need it today.
Right.
And, like, books are written on this, like, 19th century sort of production schedule, you know, where they go, oh, we promise you a quick turnover on your book, maybe as little as 8 months. We're like, what?
Wow.
But I mean, it is satisfying to hold a thing in your hand, you know, even if it's an iPad with a Kindle, it's still like, that's my book.
Yeah, that's great. So. Well, if I could ask just to sum this all up, if you could just talk directly to visual effects artists right now, what would you say to them about this whole?
Oh my goodness.
I know, I'm putting you on the spot a little bit.
I know. It's like, well, yeah, I would just say that, like, don't be afraid to think collectively, and you know. I would like to think that my talent is enough to make my way through the business, and that's the perception. But there's really more to it. I mean, it's not show art; it's show business. It's always been a business. And there are enlightened producers, and there are people who respect you, and there are people who grew up among your ranks. But there are also people who regard you as a disposable piece of software, you know, and they respect you as much as they respect a thoroughbred horse, and which is like they admire what you do, but they're not going to let you have any really say in what you want, you know. And what a union is really good for is to protect against those kind of situations. I mean, most of the producers I worked with who didn't have a problem with the union, miraculously, they're still in business. You know, I mean, when DreamWorks was setting up, Steven Spielberg looked at me and said, "Yeah, we're going to be a union studio." I'm like, okay, like, you know, he volunteered that, you know, and we never had a problem, you know, and it's like the people who do have a problem, you have to wonder why they have a problem.
Yeah, I've heard somebody say that, you know, the they could see a day when, you know, studios that aren't following the labor laws and that aren't offering portable benefits are going to have a hard time because, you know, the artists are going to want to work at the places that are respecting them and offering them those benefits.
Yeah.
And offering them, you know, the proper labor laws. And there's, you know, those abuses that are happening now will be harder to happen because people will have more – more information.
Yeah, and the idea, like, there was one studio once that was a non-union studio that, like, stiffed its employees like the last 5 weeks, salary on a project, and then they declared Chapter 11 and all, and then the same producers, like, a few months later, signed this very lucrative deal with a big studio where they're like, they're on a cover of a community newspaper holding this check for like $10 million or whatever. And what happened was the artists got together and tried to passed a hat and got enough money to go to a show business attorney and said, we want you to sue the employers. But the employer was now the exclusive employee of a very large studio. Like one of the majors. And basically the showbiz attorney just laughed in their faces and said, I'm not going to sue a corporation for you. I sue them and then they'll blacklist me and then I'll never work. They won't work with any of my clients. And so it it's funny, the attorney told him, form a union. What the hell is wrong with you? And that's not like in the 30s. That's like a couple of years ago.
So. Well, I really appreciate you taking the time to do this. I know you're in the middle of production, so I appreciate you taking the time.
Great.
Thanks very much.
Okay, thanks so much.
Well, thank you, Jeff, for that. And thank you, Tom Cito, for sitting down and talking to us and giving us a perspective on what the union situation was like in the parallel, I guess, area of cartooning and traditional animation. Of course, FX Guide basically offers no opinion other than to say that we want to inform the community, and obviously anything that improves both the profitability of the companies and the working conditions of people working in the industry are something that we think is worth bringing to your attention. I guess in a spirit of like basically informing the debate and no more. Hey, I do also want to flag this continuing series that we have on the tech behind the films. We've had a couple of them already. Great response to them. As I said at the outset, the next one is with Weta Digital and Dr. Mark Sager. Now, he's the special project supervisor from Weta Digital, and he's just received the 2011 SciTech Award for basically the continuing development of facial motion retargeting solutions or facial animation stuff. And in fact, Mark actually won last year a similar SciTech award for the work that he did in the original Light Stage stuff dating back to Light Stage 1 and 2, as you'll hear about in the interview next week. This is a really, really good interview, and I just can't thank Weta and Mark enough for making time to talk to us and go into such depth on these areas. And we've had a great response to this series, so thank you. And we have more coming up in that series, and they'll be rolled out in coming weeks. Just a couple more quick pieces of housekeeping. Firstly, I want to suggest that if you haven't already, you've got a small window that you can still get in to win our HP mobile workstation we're giving away. This is a $7,000 workstation we're giving away. If you've got some tech that you've had to struggle to make work, some inventiveness that you've had to come up with to make things actually happen in your space, send us a photo of it, and the winning entry will get a HP shipped to them. Wherever you are in the world, this is open to anyone in the world. Assuming your government allows us to give it to you, then the winning entry will have this HP workstation shipped to you. And we've got one ourselves, and they're really great. They're really robust, hardcore, big Windows machines for doing basically high processing type work that you would do here in our industry. That's available information for that at fxguide.com, where, of course, our new website is up. Well, on behalf of myself, Jeff and John Montgomery, who's now returned from a heat wave in Sydney to a snowstorm in Chicago. Thank you so much for listening. We'll catch you next week. See you.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.